For the next week I hardly seemed to have my coat on. The flood of sheep work was at its peak, and I spent hours of every day with my arms in and out of buckets of hot water in all corners of the district. In the pens, in dark nooks in farm buildings, or very often in the open fields, because the farmers of those days didn't find anything disturbing in the sight of a vet kneeling in his shirt sleeves for an hour in the rain. I had one more visit to Rob Benson's place. To a ewe with a prolapsed uterus after lambing. A job whose chief delight was comparing it with the sweat of replacing a uterus in a cow. It was so beautifully easy. Rob rolled the animal onto her side, then held her more or less upside down by tying a length of rope to her hind legs and passing it round her neck. In that position she couldn't strain, and I disinfected the organ and pushed it back with the minimum of effort, gently inserting an arm at the finish to work it properly into place. Afterwards the ewe trotted away unperturbed with her family to join the rapidly growing flock, whose din was all around us.
"Look!" Rob cried. "There's that old ewe with Herbert. Over there on right, in the middle of that bunch."
Well, they all looked the same to me, but to Rob, like all shepherds, they were as different as people, and he picked out those two effortlessly. They were near the top of the field, and as I wanted to have a close look at them, we manoeuvred them into a corner. The ewe, fiercely possessive, stamped her foot at us as we approached, and Herbert, who had discarded his woolly jacket, held close to the flank of his new mother. He was, I noticed, faintly obese in appearance.
"Well, you couldn't call him a runt now, Rob," I said.
The farmer laughed.
"Nay, t'owd lass has a bag like a cow, and Herbert's getting the lot. By gorry, he's in clover, is that little youth. And I reckon he saved the ewe's life, you know. She'd have pegged out all right, but she never looked back once he came along."
I looked away over the noisy pens, over the hundreds of sheep moving across the fields. I turned to the farmer.
"I'm afraid you've seen a lot of me lately, Rob. I hope this is the last visit."
"Aye, well, it could be. We're getting well through now. But it's hell of a time lambing, isn't it?"
"It is that. Well, I must be off. I'll leave you to it."
I turned and made my way down the hillside, my arms raw and chafing in my sleeves, my cheeks whipped by the eternal wind gusting over the grass. At the gate I stopped and gazed back at the wide landscape, ribbed and streaked by the last of the winter snow, and at the dark grey banks of cloud riding across on the wind, followed by lakes of brightest blue. And in seconds the fields and walls and woods burst into vivid life, and I had to close my eyes against the sun's glare. As I stood there, the distant uproar came faintly down to me. The tumultuous harmony from deepest bass to highest treble, demanding, anxious, angry, loving. The sound of the sheep, the sound of spring.
Chapter 4.
As the faint, rumbling growl rolled up from the ribcage into the earpieces of my stethoscope, the realization burst upon me with uncomfortable clarity that this was probably the biggest dog I'd ever seen. In my limited past experience, some Irish wolfhounds had undoubtedly been taller, and a certain number of bull mastiffs had possibly been broader. But for sheer gross poundage, this one had it. His name was Clancy. It was a good name for an Irishman's dog, and Joe Mulligan was very Irish, despite his many years in Yorkshire. Joe had brought him into the afternoon surgery, and as the huge hairy form ambled along, almost filling the passage, I was reminded of the times I had seen him out in the fields around Derby, enduring the frisky attentions of smaller animals with massive benignity. He looked like a nice, friendly dog. But now, there was this ominous sound echoing round the great thorax, like a distant drum roll in a subterranean cavern. And as the chest piece of the stethoscope bumped along the ribs, the sound swelled in volume, and the lips fluttered over the enormous teeth as though a gentle breeze had stirred them. It was then that I became aware not only that Clancy was very big indeed, but that my position, kneeling on the floor with my right ear a few inches from his mouth, was infinitely vulnerable. I got to my feet, and as I dropped the stethoscope into my pocket, the dog gave me a cold look. A sideways glance without moving his head, and there was a chilling menace in his very immobility. I didn't mind my patient snapping at me, but this one I felt sure wouldn't snap. If he started something, it would be on a spectacular scale. I stepped back a pace, Now, what did you say his symptoms were, Mr. Mulligan?
What's that, sir?
Joe cupped his ear with his hand. I took a deep breath.
What's the trouble with him?
I shouted. The old man looked at me with total incomprehension from beneath the straightly adjusted cloth cap. He fingered the muffler knotted immediately over his larynx, and the pipe which grew from the dead centre of his mouth puffed blue wisps of puzzlement. Then, remembering something of Clancy's past history, I moved close to Mr. Mulligan and bawled with all my power into his face.
Is he vomiting?
The response was immediate. Joe smiled in great relief and removed his pipe.
Oh, aye, he's vomiting, sir. He's vomiting bad.
Clearly he was on familiar ground. Over the years, Clancy's treatment had all been at long range. My young boss, Siegfried Farnon, had told me on the first day I had arrived in Garraby 2 years ago that there was nothing wrong with the dog, which he had described as a cross between an Airedale and a donkey, but his penchant for eating every bit of rubbish in his path had the inevitable result. A large bottle of bismuth, mad carb mixture, had been dispensed at regular intervals. He had also told me that Clancy, when bored, used occasionally to throw Joe to the ground and worry him like a rat just for a bit of light relief. But his master still adored him. Prickings of conscience tell me I should carry out a full examination. Take his temperature, for instance. All I had to do was to grab hold of that tail, lift it, and push a thermometer into his rectum. The dog turned his head and met my eye with a blank stare. Again I heard the low, booming drum roll, and the upper lip lifted a fraction to show a quick gleam of white.
Yes. Yes, right, Mr. Mulligan, I said briskly. I'll get you a bottle of the usual.
In the dispensary, under the rows of bottles with their Latin names and glass stoppers, I shook up the mixture in a 10-ounce bottle, corked it, stuck on a label, and wrote the directions. Joe seemed well satisfied as he pocketed the familiar white medicine, but as he turned to go, my conscience smote me again. The dog did look perfectly fit, but maybe he ought to be seen again.
Bring him back again on Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock,
I yelled into the old man's ear.
And please come on time if you can. You were a bit late today.
I watched Mr. Mulligan going down the street, preceded by his pipe, from which regular puffs rose upwards as though from a departing railway engine. Behind him ambled Clancy, a picture of massive calm. With his all-over covering of tight brown curls, he did indeed look like a gigantic Airedale. Thursday afternoon, I ruminated. That was my half-day, and at 2 o'clock I'd probably be watching the afternoon cinema show in Broughton.